compulsion around sexuality, which is the thing that we're talking about today, of could somebody be a Christian sex addict? It's like, wait a minute, you know, that's like good codependency or wonderful cancer, or, you know what I mean? How can you put those two together? And one of the huge constructs that I work with a lot is to try to get people to get the idea. Hi, Jeannie. I mean, we're such a small, intimate group, it's okay to say that. is try to get across the idea that somebody can be just an absolutely, not only wonderful human being, but deeply, and I'm using all the words I know how to use in a positive sense, spirit-filled, deeply committed Christian, and still have problems around compulsive sexual behavior. And I know lots of people like that, and I work with lots of people like that. And that's a construct that I think is an important one to get, because number one, it arms you to recognize and see behaviors and things that you might not see, because in your own mind you can say, this is either a rascal or a Christian, but it can't be a Christian that's acting like a rascal around sexual stuff. You know, so you look the other way, or you put blinders on. There's that particular thing. And also in terms of compassion, of working with somebody, in terms of psychological problems that we work with, my sense is that, for instance, we're much more understanding of and compassionate of an alcoholic, and even more, probably much more compassionate around a person who abuses food to medicate and to handle, you know, handle their emotional issues. But when it comes to sexual stuff, and see, they're all pretty parallel. Eating disorder, for instance, is very parallel with compulsive sexual behavior in terms of how the dynamics that go about to make it happen, the pain that a person's in when they overeat and what that's all about. It's just that I think lots of us have a whole lot more room, both in terms of our acceptance and in terms of our understanding. We kind of understand when somebody overeats out of some dysfunction or some pain, but don't tell me that they're gonna cross sexual boundaries. And yet the dynamics are very much the same. And it's probably closer to an eating disorder than any other kind of thing. So I try to get across the idea that somebody could be some pretty wonderful kind of person and still have huge problems in that area. Let me do, I'm rolling the tape.
Isn't that just kind of common sense? I mean, isn't that just part of being human that, you know, that one, you know, overeat or, you know, sexually addicted or whatever, is just part of the human condition? I mean, I don't see why we'd even see one as being so different from another.
Well, I guess I just think lots of folks do see them as different.
I do. I readily admit that. I mean, one you do to yourself, and one you have a victim, for one thing.
Who's the victim?
The person you sexually abuse.
Oh, are we talking about sexual abuse?
Well, I try to make it sexual abuse and or all other kinds of crossing of sexual boundaries. And so anytime, for instance, my pastor did a thing that happened in my church, and I'm looking at this at one level as sexual abuse, and I wrote him a letter, and he was really neat about it, and I talked to the education director, and he said, boy, he must have got your letter because he chewed us out. I was observing that it's a large church I attend, and that quite a bit of the talking, you wouldn't see this much at Holden, but I'm pretty sensitive to it because I do a lot of work like this. Almost invariably, with anybody but Doug, Doug's the head pastor, almost invariably, if you were to walk around and watch, when the pastors talk to a couple, they do probably 80% of the addressing of talk who they talk to the male, and occasionally will include whoever the female is, but not very often. And I wrote Doug and I said that, and some other things that were happening from the pulpit, which I think set people up to be in a one-down or victimized position. And that's a minor kind of a thing, but that's power imbalance, that's sexual abuse, or at least it sets people up to sexual abuse. And the reason I work pretty hard at trying to keep it into that welcome to that broad brush kind of thing is that it's too easy, in my mind, to take horrendous quote-unquote sexual abuse, like when somebody sexually abuses a child, everybody gets up in arms and says, let's kill that person, and you know, and all. But there's just such a wide series of other things on a kind of a grid that go back that we don't look at. And so I want to put it all together and say, let's look at the whole thing. It's a societal problem, and it always involves, in treatment, I didn't have any intention of saying this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it right now. When I'm working with people either that have been court-ordered for sexually abusing children, or, but I work with a lot of people, I've got two pastors right now that have recently had, the word they use is indiscretions in their congregation, and they've been fired, and they're coming to see us for us at our place for treatment, and they're not court ordered, there's nothing like that, but if they ever want to be pastors in their churches again, they've got to do some work around those kinds of issues. And not outside of treatment. In fact, I've never said this in one of these kind of workshops, but we use the word rape to mean any time you use a female, I'm talking now mostly about males, because that's mostly who we work with, any time you use a female sexually without her permission. So if you body part her or lustfully look at her, in a way that she's walking by, and then I don't know if anybody ever does this, but I tell people to go over to the mall in the Bellevue Square and watch, and you'll see this constant parade. In a half an hour, you'll see it 50 times, where there'll be a woman walking here and a man walking here, and she'll look at him in the eye, and he'll look down at her body. She'll look down at her body, realize, not even consciously, because it happens to her so much, then she'll glance back up and they walk by. She doesn't call the police. She doesn't hit him with her purse. Because it happens so often to women that they become immune to it anymore. But for the guys that we're working with, we say that's a form of rape. Because what you've done is you've used a female in a lustful kind of way without having any kind of permission from her. That's not an equal. So you have all the power. You can look and she can do nothing about it. So she has to, what do I do? Put gunny sack on or just not go to the mall? Or so she learns to just kind of let that kind of stuff go by. So since everything we do in treatment is on what we call breaking a cycle, which is recognizing that sexual misconduct or power imbalance, sexual abuse, in any way, never happens in a vacuum. It always happens. There's a trigger which moves to something, which moves to something, which moves to something, which moves to something. And if we can get people in the sexual compulsion area far enough up the food chain to say, we want you to fight the battle at the lustful looking area or something like that, and then we teach interventions how to break that pattern. But when we do reporting in groups, because this is so shame-based, I don't do this out in public with people, believe me, but this whole concept is so shame-based and secretive that we'll get groups of in treatment going, and we'll have people reporting where they'll use those words, and I know they're inflammatory words. I was jogging this morning, and there was a woman jogger up in front of me, and I raped her by... And we talk about that. Now, I'd never say that in public. I'm obviously making this disclaimer so much. I want to make sure you hear that we don't make that general kind of knowledge. But we want people to get the idea that that's a pretty serious invasion of the other person's property. But what's really insidious is what it does to your own mind. Because you allow that, and then you're more likely, when you get what we call high stress, low structure, opportunity, and I know I'm using little bumper sticker things, I'm talking about the person who has a compulsion around sexual behavior, and you get a trigger, a stressor, and a high-risk environment, and you're liable to do more than the look. That's where so many of the guys that I work with, so many find the classic youth leader's orientation, which is, oh, with high school girls, but it's true with young couples groups too, where you're leading the group, you're leading songs, you're leading the prayer group and everything else. You find someone in the group who you find more sexually attractive than anybody else. You set them up to kind of respond to you. You pick them out, you're a little nicer to them. Pretty soon they start feeding your ego, even to the point where they eventually, and this is what I find a lot more in the Christian community, where they make some kind of a move on you, ask you to go to coffee or do something. Oh no, I could never do that, I'm a Christian. But see, you've already gotten the stroke out of it. You've already gotten the hit out of it. And then sometimes you get so... See, that feeds the guy's ego, who's pretty insecure anyway.
And are you saying that they shouldn't say, I could go to coffee because that's kind of a boundary issue? Or because it's going to be more than sexual?
I'd say if it is a boundary issue for them, and for lots of guys it is, I don't... Let's take it over into a different arena. I don't have any problem with alcohol. Now, because I work so much with addictions and compulsions, and because my father was alcoholic, I know that I jumped from the 18% category nationally to the 65% category. I had an alcoholic father, so 65% of the chance I've got of being alcoholic. So periodically, I go a month without drinking anything. Sometimes I go a month anyway. I don't drink that much, but I don't have any problem with drinking. But I periodically check myself anyway. But if I had a problem with drinking, then it would be important for me to set some real strict boundaries and not do certain things so that I wouldn't get in trouble there. Yes, I am saying that with certain guys. I think some guys have absolutely no problem at all and don't worry about it. But for some guys, either internally who come to treatment on their own and say, this is a problem, what I get most of the time there are people with multiple affairs who, for the last 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, a professional singer who's on the road 200 days a year, who does that, a vice president of a company who had 17 affairs in 12 years, and just got so eaten and consumed with the guilt that he finally took the risk of breaking all this to his wife, and because that's a huge risk, because if in truth he is a sexual addict, whatever that is, if in truth he is, versus someone who's just out being a ding-dong, you know, and you tell somebody that's doing something really bad or really dumb or really stupid to stop, they can stop. But you try to tell an alcoholic to stop drinking and just say quit. Or you try to tell somebody who's compulsive in their eating, just quit doing it. That's dumb. They'll tell you, yes, you're right, I will, but they can't. And a person who, for instance, gets their emotional needs met by the multiple affair kind of thing often is the same guy who sits in my office and just is in pain you wouldn't believe because he can't stop. And he keeps falling back into the pattern and falling back into the pattern. And it's always the same intense kind of thing where he's glad he got caught because he knows that he'll never, ever change that behavior pattern. And the reason for that, I mean, life is never simple with this, but the reason for that, I'm talking about the person who's compulsive in their sexual behavior versus the person who's just making some decisions that are not good decisions, and there really is a difference. Person that's compulsive, among many other things that they're dealing with, is the deepest fear of abandonment you're ever going to see in your life. And so what they have to do is they build their whole sexual life in secrecy, which means they're isolated. It means they're not able to go to the people who are most supportive of them, who they love the most, and say, I go out and tell you I'm going to meetings, but what I do is go peep in windows, or what I do is go have affairs, or whatever. Because their deepest, deepest, deepest fear, right down to the marrow of their bones, is that if I tell you my secrets, you'll leave me. And in reality, it may be that you will. And that's a risk that's so intensely high that they build this whole secret life. And if we do anything in treatment, anything at all, anywhere from running a two-day seminar to try to get people to pay attention to this all the way to working with somebody for 2 years intensely, it's to get to the point where you're willing to risk breaking your secrets. Because if you begin to break your secrets, there's a chance to get out from under this stuff. If you keep it secret, you'll stay crazy. And you'll return to the pattern over and over and over. And I've worked with guys, the longest that I'm aware of is a guy that couldn't come clean with all his stuff. And 11-year break, and then he just went back to his stuff. But you see, I have a friend who's an attorney. Again, I keep trying to make these comparisons because they're comparisons that we understand a little better. He was alcoholic and he went 14 years dry. Life was going very well. Then he was drunk for 8 months. Lost his marriage, almost lost his license to be an attorney. Now he's 6 years dry again. And he says he had a wake-up call. He thinks he gets it this time. So do you see the comparison I make there, that a person can learn to set really healthy boundaries and do all those kind of things, but eventually in treatment they have to come internally out instead of outside in. For instance, most every church that I work with, in one way or another, will have a ground rule. Men don't counsel with women after 5 o'clock in the office at the church. But see, that's an external boundary. Every pastor I know will say, in a crisis thing, oh, well, yeah, but it was just a crisis. There's enough, and for most guys, that's okay. I mean, you know, it's good to set the rule because you ought to go home sometimes. But the other side of it is, they're not compulsive about that behavior. But for the compulsive guy, he's got to really set strong, strong, strong boundaries about that and a number of other things. And eventually they've got to come inside out, because nobody else can work your program for you. It can't be done externally.
And you're saying he has to set strong boundaries because he's more liable to violate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he's more liable to violate in a progressive pattern rather than some instantaneous kind of thing. It's kind of like running a marathon versus running a sprint. And maybe there are, I'm picking on pastors now, for the pastor who handles his pain and his loneliness and his insecurity in this manner, that's kind of a nice framing of it, he may have, if you look at a marathon, relationships that he's working on with parishioners or with other people. Some are at 2 miles into the race, and some are at 15 miles into the race, and some are at 18 miles into the race, and some are at about 25 miles into the race. And he may have varying levels of what happens for him in that relationship, but most of it is kind of a setting up, kind of a grooming pattern, kind of a, eventually, the incredible power, particularly of somebody who's pretty charismatic, of sharing their own pain, sharing their own hurt, talking about how things really don't work well with my wife and I, and all this kind of stuff begins to go, and pretty soon she starts feeling just overwhelmed with the power of being able to help him, because he's this figure who brings the gospel. And again, I'll go back to the thing that I don't think that means on Sunday morning he's a bad guy necessarily. Any more than, and I know I'm giving you examples that are jarring, any more than the fella who, well, I'm going to show you this video in a minute. I'm trying to use the video of a guy who I think is very winsome. And I don't know if he comes across winsome, but he's really a nice guy. School teacher, just an outstanding guy. Dad's a pastor, and an educator, raised in a Christian home, Christian education. And the reason I'm throwing the Christian stuff in is because I think I know him well. Had him in treatment for 4 years. Know this guy inside and out. And I believe his sincerity. But he also could and would molest kids and was a great teacher. Not just an okay teacher. For many kids, because he didn't do that indiscriminately. It doesn't say this in the little thing that I'm going to show you on the video, but his primary thing on his paraphilia is the fancy word, is, he's not acting on it now, but that will never go away, is voyeurism. So, because he's a community caretaker, and because he touched a child, not in even a more typical kind of sense, community caretakers, ministers, teachers, doctors, therapists, get longer sentencing. He got 5 years. Normally it's 2 to 3 years, but if you're a community caretaker and you break a law, he didn't even get arrested for his long-term pattern of voyeurism. And what he would do in his voyeurism pattern, which was oddly enough, he'd say, "Now wait a minute, Bill, this guy's there for molesting a child, but you mostly worked on his voyeurism." But that was really what his deep-seated pattern and problem was. He would go to Nordstrom's, don't ask me why Nordstrom's, and he would go into the place where you change clothing, and he told me, and I never paid attention to it. I learned a lot of stuff that you might not learn any other way. In the place where women change clothes, in Nordstrom's at least, in Bellevue, there's a board that only goes down about this much room from the floor, from all these little rooms where you dress. And he would bumble into the women's dressing room, and if nobody saw him, go in one of those little kind of places and then lay down on the floor where he could watch other people dress. And he said, if I positioned himself just right, he could see you up to about here, but if he couldn't see your face, you couldn't see him. And so he had all this down to a sense. He did that for 7 or 8 years on a regular, compulsive basis. At the same time, he was teaching school and teaching Sunday school. And then it gets into the grind. It's like, how do you live with yourself? What do you do with this? And he was a guy who I really believe was genuinely happy when he got caught, because it was tearing him up. And of course, Jenny, who has chosen to stay with him in this case, she knew nothing about this, because with the classic fear of abandonment, you think he was going to tell her about this? Far as she knew, this was a pastor's son who went to, I think, Azusa Pacific and got a master's degree and was a coach of his little basketball team that went to the state and was a nationally recognized wrestler and trombone, you know, just all the kind of things that you think as a husband is really pretty wonderful. But he had this whole secret package going that hurt other people and hurt him.
And was he so good at covering it up, or was...
Yes.
Well, that's the thing. In a former congregation with a former pastor, for 10 years, even in the congregation where he served before, I can't believe in 10 years how that could go on and on and he could preach the gospel. To me, that's just...
And it doesn't work. I mean, you don't know how to put that together, but imagine how he puts it together.
Wow.
See, it's just like... It doesn't work, so what he has to do is compartmentalize. And I don't say that as an excuse. What I was trying to say yesterday is none of this is an excuse, but it sometimes explains the behavior that what the person does is they learn to compartmentalize. This is that part of me, and this is this part of me who's a father, and this is this part of me who's a pastor. And they get pretty rigid, and when folks are pretty healthy, there's a fairly even flow of the parts of me and you that are, like you talk about evil, and I've got parts of me that get angry, and I've got parts of me where I hurt people, and it's not predominantly me, but I also don't have them compartmentalized so tightly And I jokingly say, I'm a plumber. You know, if you start filling that stuff up with water, you got to drill some holes to get the water flowing back and forth. And when you get so tightly compartmentalized, what you can do is over a period of time, not even bring that behavior into the rest of the stuff and be very genuine in preaching the gospel and praying for the sick and doing all that, because you've kind of gotten hardening of the categories and you've isolated that so tightly. And I don't know how to break that other than to storm in and break it with an intervention. Now, that's not quite true. I've been doing this, I mean, this isn't all I do. I do other stuff too, because I think this stuff will get you crazy. But I was thinking about that when I was hearing about your death and dying stuff, and I think, I work with a portion of the population with sex abuse and sex addiction, but I do other stuff. But I was thinking, how do you do this if you work mostly, you know, I don't know that I could do that, and that's good that you could, you know, I know I couldn't do this work only, but I see it, and I see over 14 years of doing this work, 14, 15, I've worked with maybe 3-4 people who've come in on their own and just said, this is crazy and I've got to have help. Working with a fellow right now who was with YWAM, which is a missionary group, and he's probably a pretty classic pedophile. It just has sexual energy towards children, and he hates it, it disgusts him, and he's coming on his own, you know, and he's real convicted. But we will never take that urge away. We'll teach him all kinds of interventions and boundaries and things to do. And I don't ever want him to be a missionary again, you know. But he's a very open person to this and saying, this is crazy and I've got to have help. That's very rare. In almost every case, the work is so intrusive, so frightening to the person about breaking secrets with boundaries, I mean with abandonment issues, so expensive, so intense, and the cost is so high that rarely do I see anybody stay the course if they're not forced to. Forced to can mean I'm working with a guy right now, he's 65 years old, and what happened for him was daughter and wife said, there's nothing illegal about his stuff, but you'll get into treatment or we're out of here. So he's got that pressure. Mm-hmm. Or the church has an intervention, or a law firm that had me come in with all the partners, talk to one of the partners. Do you know what I mean? But there's pressure of some sort. I don't see folks doing it without something that says, you got to do it.
Well, I think he just finally... We don't know if he got pressure from one of the victims finally, or if he just his conscience just means, I can't do this anymore.
But see, unless the other things change, he'll go somewhere else and do it again. That makes me nervous. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
You do all this therapy and intervention and learning how to control these urges, addictions.
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody making any progress on figuring out, or is it part of your therapy, going back to the root of why? Is that why you look back at a person's history and know why? I mean, is it something chemical? Is it something they were abandoned by their parents? Were they? I mean, you said yesterday almost all people who abused were abused.
Most of them that I've worked with, yes.
Is that the core of it? And their anger at being abused, they take it out. Why? Why?
Hi. We have an intimate group, Margaret. You can join it up there or down here. Before I answer that, let me say that lots of therapists, and I think they're well-meaning, but their therapy doesn't work, try to work at a lot of the why. And that's because they don't understand addictions very much. How can I say this? I do lots of talks to very small groups of people, and I work with lots of folks. Do you know what I'm saying? Everybody doesn't come to hear about this. Mm-hmm. And I do lots of work with clients who say, I've been to four therapists, and none of them really understood. And what happens there, and here we take it from the alcohol, you have to get out of the behaviors and know how, what we call it, is get away from being toxic. You have to get away from being toxic, and you have to get good tools not to return to the behaviors before you can do the work on why. And what lots of therapists will do is try to work on why while you're still crazy. And it has never worked in the history of the world.
And that's why the 12-step programs work.
That's why the 12-step programs work when they work. And that's why we, in, if I have somebody court-ordered, they have to go to 12-step. If they're not court-ordered, I talk to them every week. Did you go to 12-step meeting this week? I want that as an adjunct to what we do. Now, one of the things that's dramatically different from what we do a lot of, when we first get people, we do a lot of support confront. And after we work with them a while, we do a lot of confront support. But if you're going to work with this kind of an issue, you really have to communicate. I hiked in with some guys this week that are really well along in our program, and they wanted to do a little Outward Boundy kind of thing, and we hiked in, and then we saw that great redemption movie, The Lion King, and we looked at that and talked late that evening. And one of the guys said, Bill, what I like is you sell me your mind and you give me your heart. I never thought it was a nice way to speak, but I'm professional and I confront and I hold accountable. And I love the folks that I'm working with because I tell them, the work is too hard. I can't do this if I don't love you. And I don't. I send them to somebody else. If I can't get some kind of a heart connection, I can't do this work. Interesting enough, I can work with attention deficit disorder kids without loving them. And I can, you know what I mean? I can be professional. But this stuff is so painful and so difficult that if I find a person that I can't get some affective connection with, I'll send them to somebody else. But the other side is, I do a lot of confronting until we get some kind of real clarity about taking responsibility, moving away from, well, the reason I do this is because I was abused or I was this or I was that. We have a lot of folks. I do a fair amount of television stuff. I was kind of laughing thinking about that because I know Bree and I were on a national television show. Not that it was a very big deal. It was the Jerry Springer show, and I'd never been on it. And now I know what trash talk is all about. But we went back and did the Jerry Springer show, and I've been on TV, and I do all this, and I do all that. But it still comes down to folks have got to either really want to make the changes in themselves or understand this kind of stuff. And a lot of it is confrontational. A lot of it is holding people accountable. A lot of it is opening up cans of worms that you wouldn't believe you'd be willing to open up. But I don't think there's any way to healing short of that. So we do a lot of confrontation and holding accountable for a while. At the same time, we have to support a lot because lots of folks get pretty depressed, pretty suicidal, and very fearful of the abandonment. Very fearful that you're going to have me tell my wife all this stuff. Yeah. All of it? Yeah. I mean, I'll help you. I'll walk with you. I'll go through a sheet of paper on how to do it. You know what I mean? But yeah, you got to get clean and you got to get healthy, and that may take a year. That may take 2 years. Then we do a lot more working back with, where do you think this came from? And over and over and over, when they write what we call autobiographies, sexual autobiographies, and all this kind of stuff, over and over, I've watched this process, so I've really come to trust it. And that is, while you're crazy, there's no way in the world you could ever figure out how it happened. As you get real distance and real clarity, two things happen. You really begin to get an idea about why it happened, and it doesn't matter anymore. Because you don't need to do it anymore. I can tell you right down to a gnat's eyebrow in my own life some things about where I was sexually abused by some girls and the impact that had on me and what I had to learn about relationships and how for a long time some things that I did that grew out of that. But you know, okay, so what? That isn't really what's crucial. What's crucial is that in my own life, and I'll lead that to something that this is interesting, it's taking me somewhere where I wasn't planning to go, but that's okay. If you look at healthy behavior in terms of sexuality as being somewhere right here in the middle and everybody kind of, you know, slip a little bit, but it's all pretty appropriate, that pendulum swings way over here and you're acting out, meaning you're doing something that's inappropriate. And as I said yesterday, it's always power imbalanced. You're always using your position of you're better looking or you're the boss or you're something to have someone respond to you in a sexual manner. That's acting out. What's just as unhealthy is acting in, where you're thinking about it, oh my gosh, I can't do this, this is awful, but you're focusing so much on the inappropriate behavior that you're just as dysfunctional. So sometimes we have to work with folks who may not have done a broad range of external kinds of things, but they're so obsessively focused on, I must not, I cannot. Does that make any sense to you? So acting in can be as problematic to you as acting out. It's not as problematic to people around you, but when we help people get past that and they get more freed up and get more relaxed, set better boundaries internally, and don't get into situations, it's amazing. Guys get better jobs. There's all kinds of energy to do things that you just don't understand otherwise.
But what about those who do the acting in and never do cross any boundary? Or, I mean, is that you ever run across that?
Yes. Yeah. And never cross to me is kind of like this. I'm not going to go put it on the board. You got this pendulum swing like this. And I'd say that all of us do some. I don't know what some is. Either we act out some or we act in some. I don't believe present company accepted, not excluded. I don't think there are any of us that don't inappropriately handle our sexuality at times. Most of us do that in such a manner that it doesn't really create that much damage to us or someone else. And thank goodness we have enough guilt to keep us in line. And of course, I know I'm using jargon words, but I call guilt good and shame bad. A little guilt doesn't hurt you a bit. You say something inappropriate, or you're at a party and you drink two beers and you kiss somebody. That's not appropriate, and you feel guilty about it, and you go talk to your wife and you say, this was nuts, I can't, and you break that. See, right there, you've broken the secret. And keeping the secret's what gets you in trouble. And so, okay, so you did that, and that's guilt. Shame is where you build it deeply into your secrecy, and I know I'm talking bumper sticker talk, except it's real. It's shame becomes what I am, not what I do. You can feel guilty and change your behavior because you feel bad about something you do. And if you're willing to break secrets, it doesn't tap into the whole abandonment thing. Shame taps into the whole abandonment thing. I'm shamed because bottom line is I'm less than other people. And the only reason I get to sit in the room if I'm shamed is because I work harder, I try harder. It's all behavior, and I'm going to try to earn my way into your presence, and I'm really very, very shamed. And if your sexual behavior taps into your shame, all it does is create more shame and more hurt. So when I hear people being, as funny as it sounds, being guilty, I cheer. And when I hear people being shamed, I hug them and hold them and feel sad and sometimes cry with them. Because that's just terribly painful stuff. But I also say it's not okay. It's not okay. I wrote a paper recently in which I took some folks to task. It's in a journal that none of you would ever hear of called the Journal of Compulsive Behavior and Addiction. Now, who in the world would ever hear of a journal like that? But a position I took in the paper, which is a difficult position for addiction workers, is that once we understand all the patterns and problems and what that is, and you either get treatment or do 12-step enough or do something, but you know what your boundaries are, you know what you need to do, then one of the tenets that we have is that this kind of problem is not a moral issue and not a willpower issue. Let me stop there before I finish. Does that make some sense to you? If you're talking about a compulsive behavior, I don't think you're a bad person because you do it. Because the truth is, you don't have the ability not to do it. And that's not a moral issue. But once you get into treatment, you learn the interventions, you learn all that, you're not toxic anymore. I took the position in the paper that maybe now it does become a moral issue. Maybe now you got some responsibility because you know what to do. You're not toxic anymore. You know this. I wrote that article a little fear and trembling because addictionologists in general don't take that position, but I don't know what to say about that other than I've had enough success with folks who say, who fed that information back to me, that even part of their self respect comes from the fact that now I know. Now, in knowing how to not get back in the behavior, what they may need to do is go to 5 SA meetings, Sexaholics Anonymous meetings a week. They may need to do that. They may need to do a number of different things because anytime you're dealing with addiction, one of my bumper sticker words is it's a do program, it's not a don't program. That's what I mean about willpower. You can't just say, well, I'll never do this again. Yeah, sure, you'll never do it again until you're frightened or hurt or feeling secretive or people made fun of you or you got your feelings hurt or, you know, lots of bad stuff. And since it's a medication, you'll go back to the medication. So you can't say it's a willpower thing. But once I've had folks tell me, I met with a young woman who's in a ministry now with people with AIDS. And she, don't ask me why. She's had a heart for that for years. But in her mind, since she was acting out sexually, which she was, and she's a real, I don't get many women, but she was a real classic sex addict. She couldn't do the ministry that she wanted to do because she didn't feel worthy. Had lunch with her about 2 weeks ago, and we were just talking, and she's saying, my life is so different now, and I'm doing the ministry, and I feel so good. But she said, it is a moral issue for me now, but I know how to do it. I know how not to work too much. She's an executive in a company. I know how to get my rest. She does the classic stuff they teach in 12-step. Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. H-A-L-T. She works that now. She used to work 16 hours a day. She didn't get herself that tired anymore. I digress. You want to see that tape? I thought I'd show it to you because let me show you two things quick, and then I want you to look for these things before you see it. This is called Change on the Run. You just went through 5 overheads that I didn't do. So this part I haven't changed from some of you that were here 4 years ago, but why would I expect that you would remember it? So let me show you. I want to show you two things before I show you the tape. One of them is, one of the things we teach, and it's so important for people to really incorporate in their life around compulsive behavior, is what you need and what you want. People that get involved in any compulsive behavior lose choice, and they move into a need state versus a want state. We call that being crazy. That's JPN. That's just plain nuts. Because when you think, oh, but the reason I put the little thermometer there, up here, is because I want folks to understand that you can want something or need something just as intensively. So you can't tell the difference. Do I want it or do I need it? Do I want to hike into Holden because my pipes are clogged emotionally and I do better when I get out in the woods now and then, or do I need it? Well, I don't need it. But if I think I need it, I'll get my life crazy and operate as if I need it. And I don't. I need air and I need water and I need, you know, temperature control and I need to excrete some stuff, but I don't need much of the rest. Here's the, I'm doing this more quickly than I would, but I want to show you the tape. Here's the tricky part. you do need, in the need sense, you need to be physically and emotionally touched. You will die if you don't get that. And if you don't die, you'll get crazy and try to get it another way. It isn't only babies that need to be physically and emotionally touched. You have to have that. Most adults don't die if they're not getting physically and emotionally touched enough. They just get crazy and they go get it some other way. But if your quota is 10 hugs or whatever it is you've got to have, if you haven't figured out how to get that, you will get in crazy ways to get that. You need that. And I can go into all kinds of reasons to show that, but I'm not going to take the time today. A lot of us get confused with that and think that's genital or sexual. And it has nothing to do with that. So I can't tell you the number of people I work with who get crazy around not getting enough physical or emotional touch, go from their primary relationship to a secondary relationship, consciously or unconsciously trying to get some physical or emotional touch. It gets crazy because it feels so good. It gets sexual. And I'm not saying that isn't fun, and I'm not saying that they don't enjoy that, but that isn't necessarily what they went for. But now you're out on a limb. What do? Come back and tell your wife now, well, that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years, and that. So then you build a whole secret life, and then you can addict to that process. Didn't start there. Does that make sense? An addiction can take on a life of its own. It doesn't always have to come from, I was lonely today and I turned somewhere else. After you do it enough times, it can begin to be such a patterned behavior that it can take on a life of its own. So I talk about need and want. And the other thing that I want you to look at when you watch my friend Dan here is what I call the core beliefs of an addict. And this has just proven so true that I don't even change it, because it's just some of those things like Shakespeare, you know, the stuff keeps being true. There's four core beliefs that every addict I work with have. One is a basic belief that there's something wrong with me. Somewhere I didn't line up. You know, I'm one brick short. I got some self-esteem stuff. I just didn't get what other folks got. Somehow I'm less than. Be careful not to assume that the person who has a basic self-esteem issue is not highly functional or highly adequate. Because just like the hamster can run on that little cage, often the person in this category, if they also happen to be bright and capable and charismatic and whatever, they may achieve pretty good positions of power, but deep down they're pretty fragile. Second thing is, nobody's going to love me as I am. And when I say as I am, that means telling you my secrets. That means telling you on a day-to-day basis everything that's going on and who I am and what I do and what I want and what I'm afraid of and what I'm angry about. And you got to have somewhere to go with that if you're an addict, because that builds up and gets you very, very crazy. What time is it? How am I?
You have 6 minutes.
Oh, well, forget this. I'm going to finish this. But that's where the secrets come, and that's where the abandonment issues come from. I can't risk telling you. Can you imagine what a catch-22 you're in? The biggest fear I have in my life is telling you I'm the pastor and standing up and telling you in the pulpit on Sunday morning, this is my issue. Are you guys going to crucify me, or are you going to work with me? Can you imagine that? On the other hand, his only salvation is to stand up there on Sunday morning and break the secrets. It's the only way it's going to get out from under. Or put that metaphor anywhere, with your wife, with your children. People that I get into sexual addiction issues when I do a family confrontation or intervention, a guy will say to me, well, yeah, you can tell my wife, don't tell my kids. Or don't tell my mother, because she's 76 and she'll die. Or, I mean, there's all these control issues. And I understand them, but they won't work. Third one is, my needs are never going to be met if I must depend on others, which means I've got to stay isolated. Bottom line, I can't touch other people. Can't handle this. Don't you realize that people will throw me away? And the fourth one is that sex is my most important need, in the sense that I used need and want, you know, like sex is not a want, it's a need. And if I get into a deprived state, and I mean in the very generic sense, I may have to try to hook somebody into making me feel good. Because, and that can be very sexual, and it can also get pretty crazy. So, I can't show you that. The film takes about 15 minutes. So what are we going to do? What's it? Oh, it's a fellow that, well, let me start it. He's just courageous enough and has let me do this, and then, so. And I'd like you to see some of that if we can. Paul, you said I pushed this twice?
Once. Where's this play to? The top of the circle? There you go.
We're hooking. We're cooking.
Talk to you a little bit. With your own.
My name is Dan. And,
why don't you sit over here and have a look at it? You can't see him from there. Stand.
So I get rolling today. They don't often get up in front of these people and talk, so I'm.
Who's doing this like for a group like this?
Yeah, let me know if I'm not speaking loud enough every time I get talking. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about myself to start with. And you can wade through it. I was born in Portage, Wisconsin, February 28, 1960. And I was one of four kids. I was the youngest. My mom died when I was a year and a half old. And after that, we moved around almost every year when I was growing up. We moved around from places, Wisconsin to Arkansas, to Montana, to Arizona, to California, to Oregon, to Washington, back to California, and kept on moving. And so I kind of developed a taste for travel and no real roots of any sort. In high school, I excelled in sports and academics and music. I was a high achiever. Won first place in a national competition on trombone. I grew up in a strong moral Christian family. My dad was a minister for 10 years and then became a teacher. He taught in public schools for 15 years and then went into teaching in Christian schools. I went to college at Azusa Pacific University in California, and I graduated cum laude. And I spent, during my college years, I spent two summers in Canada working at the campus, counselor and water ski instructor, where I decided that I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to work with young people. And after graduation from college, where I got my BA in education, I decided to go to Alaska with three of my college buddies. The four of us went up there to work off our college bills in the fishing industry. And we got, toward the end of the summer, we made our goal, and one of the guys that came up there with me suggested I apply some schools up there. So I did, and they hired me, and I stayed up there and taught school in Alaska for 2 years. And then I came down to Seattle, back to Washington, and got my master's. I worked on my master's degree, and then I went back another year and taught another year in Alaska. While I was there, I coached girls varsity basketball team to state. We didn't win, but we got there. And I coached boys junior high and girls junior high basketball and some wrestling. So I enjoyed coaching. I enjoyed athletics, and English was my specialty. So that's kind of a little bit about what I do when I teach you. I moved back to Seattle and studied after I got my master's degree. I taught 1 year in Washington, then taught a year in Hawaii, where I finally got up the courage to ask Jenny to marry me. And this is my wife, Jenny. and I taught over there a year, and then we moved back to Seattle in 1987. That year I decided that I was going to substitute in the public schools here, and I substituted for almost a year, started substituting a year, and that gets me pretty much up to where I am now. Any questions so far? On May 18th, 1989, I was substituting in a second grade classroom, and during the course of the day, I groomed and manipulated an 8-year-old girl to stay after school with me and help me with some projects, so I said. I proceeded to manipulate her into the storage closet to help me get some boxes on a high shelf, so I said. I proceeded to lift her up 3 times in succession, touching her on her vagina on the outside of her panties, 3 times. And I did that for my own sexual gratification, because I wanted to. The last time I put her down, I rubbed her on my penis, as I was putting her down on the floor. Proceeded to dismiss her. She went home, and the next Monday, I was asked to come in, and I was relieved of the opportunity to teach, and proceeded to go through the judicial process. And 2.5 months later, I came out of denial and admitted what I did. And leading up to that particular event, there were types of behavior that occurred that I did that got me to that point. While substituting in junior high and high school, I substituted most of the time. I'd sit in front of the class and glance at the girls' dresses, that when they're sitting at their desks. And in elementary schools, I manipulated girls to stand up on chairs and things like that, to put things up on a shelf and manipulate them to be in the classroom by themselves with me. And I would lift up their dress for my own sexual gratification. And other precursors were, I have a lifetime series of voyeuristic activities where it's a peeping behavior. Trying to be specific.
Yes.
Okay. I would sneak into women's dressing rooms in department stores and play like I'm trying on pants or something, and I would look under the stalls at women dressing and masturbate on them. That particular behavior I did most of my life. It's a long-term behavior. Some other behaviors were fantasizing, a lot of fantasizing, R-rated videos, usually where women are being taken advantage of, rape scenes, things like that. Compulsive masturbation, a lot of lustful looking. And when I was in 8th grade, I molested 3 girls, all of whom were about 6 years old, one of whom was my cousin. And I also attempted to rape a woman when I was 20 years old in a laundromat. And I was never caught for that. I don't know if I need to say that, but I wasn't. And I don't know if I'm going to stop at that. I'm now 31. I'm actually 33. Long time ago. I'm 33 and still serving a 5-year sentence, of which the judge sentenced me to 5 years in prison for child molestation 1. I suspended it on the understanding that I complete a student program, which I am now continuing to be in the bill in it, and that some of the other things involved that are no contact with minors. There is such a thing outside of prison, to have no problem.
I think I'll stop that just because we're late. My attempt, I don't know if it was a success or not, was to try to show, have someone who is a very adequate guy. Of course, he can't ever teach school again. He drives a truck now, and I think he's integrated pretty well what the problem is, and